I'm Steve McLeod, and this is Bootstrapped, the podcast for people running bootstrapped software companies or wanting to run one. I run two bootstrapped software products, Feature Upvote, which lets your customers vote on ideas to improve your product, and Saber Feedback, which offers a feedback widget you can add to your website. Follow along as I learn from talking to other bootstrappers and experts, and just maybe you'll learn something too.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Bootstrapped podcast. I'm filling in here for Steve. He's taking a little bit of a summer break, and I am joined today by my good friend, Adam DeVander. Adam and I have known each other for many years, Adam. How long has it been?
Yeah, 2009, 2010 era. Yeah, for sure.
We used to hand make the internet every single day.
Back then. That's right.
No, we got to know each other because we were working together on some open source projects around mapping and stuff. Briefly introduce yourself. Tell us exactly what you do and what do you do now and why have I brought you back here today to talk with us?
Yeah, so now I am the founder of Every Developer, and we work with API companies to help them engage developer audiences. And so I got there through several stints in marketing roles. But as you reference, I've been a developer in the past. And then I think our second time of connecting was when I was the editor of Programmable Web, which is a directory of APIs.
Right.
And that's kind of where I saw some kind of technical communications mistakes that are commonly made. And that's kind of what led to this route that I'm in now, where I help companies connect with developers and attract developers.
Right. And so you've been doing that for a few years now, I guess? You've had your own
business?
Yeah.
Almost 3 years as Every Developer, yeah.
And we should show people. I got a copy of your book here. Now
you
took all that wisdom that you've gathered and you've printed it on paper. So always a good way to impress people when you got the book out.
And I was writing a book when we first met.
Oh, is this your second book?
So I wrote a book on map scripting.
Oh, right. Of course. Yeah. You wrote a book way back in the day. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and so I figure a book a decade seems about right. So it was time. So Developer Marketing Does Not Exist is the new book.
Well, there's a lot to unpack here, Adam. So first of all, I want to get into your experience of targeting developers, because many of our listeners are people that are trying to building tools for other people. Not all for developers, but many of them are developers themselves. You know, typical bootstrapper comes from a technical background. So I'm sure you've learned a lot along the way there about some of the mistakes developers make or the biases people have. And then I guess finally, I mean, you yourself are a bootstrapper as well, in a sense. I mean, your own business is, you know, you're a founder of your own business. So it'd be interesting to unpack how the whole process of writing the book and how that's helped grow your business and things. So where should we start?
I'm a bootstrapped listener as well. And
That's right. And yeah, you've been a loyal long-term listener.
Many episodes. Yeah. And so for sure, I definitely think about my business that way as well. And yeah, and actually the book previously, I worked with a publisher. It was an 18-month long slog of a process to publish a 300-plus page book. It was a great experience with the publisher, but I wanted something lighter weight and sort of more within my control this time. And so I did take a self-published approach. I wrote it actually pretty quickly, the first draft in a month.
Wow.
And then worked with an editor to get it ready for prime time. Yeah.
And so what made you write a book to begin with? Like, what made you say, like, okay, this is the best use of my time?
It was something I wanted to do. And so sometime in early 2020, I said, oh boy, I sure would like to write this book, which the title came from, I've given it as a talk before. And so it was something I wanted to do, but I thought, how can I do that since I'm also running a business here at the same time? And so what I did was I let the couple of people on my team know my plan was to take December off from client delivery. And we worked our way backwards from that to be able to clear my time. So I really did have a mostly empty schedule for December, which allowed, you know, a couple hours a day of writing and then the rest for the family stuff that happens that time of year.
And what most of the content you already had from talks and things like that and from newsletters and blog posts, or
Most of it was written new. There were a couple of spots where I could do some cutting and pasting, but it was definitely all in my head. That was the difference. And also starting, say, May of last year, I had a long time to sort of think through what's this outline, what are the things I want to put in this. And so, yeah, I had all of that done by December 1st. I was able to just jump in and write what felt like the natural thing to write about at that time.
And how much of the first draft survives? I mean, how much it lands on the cutting room floor?
Surprisingly large amount of it is is in there, but I think it does have to do with having, you know, you mentioned the Every Developer newsletter.
Right.
You know, pieces of that and stories had been inserted before. So it was definitely, you know, most of it I'd probably written or spoken in some way before it ended up in the book.
Okay. And so then you got a draft, and then what happens? Then you got to format it or something, or what do you do?
Yeah, I worked with an editor to do a development pass on it. So basically they read the whole thing and then gave me like 5 or 6 pages worth of notes. And I sat on that for a couple of weeks and then went back to that editor and said, could I work with you to just make those edits and suggestions that you've laid out here? And so then we did that over the next month and a half or so, I'd say. And then, yes, worked with someone to do the layout and did 99 designs for a cover, and then hired a self-publishing kind of consultant to help with some of the, he'd been there many, many times. So it was kind of like, what should I do? Where do I go? What buttons do I click?
Right. Yeah. I hadn't realized there were consultants around that, but okay. How much does something like that cost? How much does a self-publishing consultant charge?
I actually found him on Clarity. And so I think I first had like a call with him that was, you know, $60 or something like that.
Right, okay.
Yeah. And then he had a few packages that I could sort of bulk buy some of his time so that I could kind of ask questions as I had them. And then for the most part, I did it myself in the true, you know, bootstrapped way, right?
Okay. And then the book comes out and what? And then the New York Times calls what happens next?
You know, my son read New York Times bestseller on one of his books recently, and he shrugged and he said, everything's a New York Times bestseller.
It's true. It's true, man.
Because all the stuff he sees, I guess, is, yeah.
Well, they have a lot of different categories and stuff. Yeah. So.
It's a fairly niche audience, as you might imagine, someone who wants to reach developers. So, yeah. So, I mean, through my sort of my own channels, I was able to get the word out. And you asked about why I would want to do that. Certainly, it's great to get it in the hands of people and make a little bit, but...
Well, I guess that's what I'm wondering. Is this an effective marketing tool? Is it a customer acquisition tool? Would you say you've seen a boost in business since it came out, or it's just...
Yeah, it's both of those for sure for me. So, and I can trace, I mean, it's only been a little over a month. I can trace a couple of leads directly to someone mentioning my book, but even those who had already found me before, I mean, I hop on sales calls and almost everybody holds up the book. It's pretty rare now not to do what those on the video can see you're doing now. And so it's definitely helped. You know, I think that people kind of get a little taste of the philosophy that I have. And that's actually, I mean, I, you know, as far as something that listeners can take away here, that's something that I think every company has anyway. And I think it's probably doubly true of developer-focused companies, is there's an opinion, a point of view upon which your business was founded. Yeah. And so that's definitely the case for every developer. And so the book helps communicate what that point of view is, even just in the title. And so I feel like that helps attract the right people.
I see. So yeah, but through your positioning, you're making sure that the right potential customers are even coming to you. Well, I bought the book as soon as it came out. I've known you for a long time, but you know, and I read your newsletter, which is excellent. I recommend to all listeners out there who are doing anything targeting developers to get on your newsletter. But and I've also worked with you. I've hired your company. You did some work for us last year. But let's get into the meat of the book, the topic. So what? Yeah. Anyone out there, what should a bootstrapper do out there who's building a product for developers? You know, what are your key tenets? What's the main advice?
Yeah. So I'll talk first about a mistake that a lot of, especially marketers, make when they're attempting to reach developers. Often, if they don't have the technical backgrounds, then they lead just with sort of whatever they can figure out about what the product is, which then ends up breaking that kind of core marketing, telling about features instead of benefits, because they can't understand the benefits as well. And I think that bootstrappers are in a good spot because they're a lot closer to the customer. And as you mentioned, I think many bootstrappers of dev-focused products are probably devs, or at least have more technical background. That's not always the case. And there are still mistakes to make, even with the focusing too much on the technology can happen if you're technical also. But the kind of core message of the book and of the work that we do is to educate and inspire developers, not promote at developers. And so when I say developer marketing does not exist, you know, obviously, I mean, there's developer marketers. People need to reach developers. It exists in some way, but you need to kind of change your mindset to think, how could I reach someone without doing the marketing things that I might do with other non-developer products to be able to first reach them?
Yeah. So, I mean, we in some of the work we did together for my business, but also in the book, it seems like your core message is you should demonstrate technical expertise, show people that I'm the expert on this topic, show them that it's very complicated, and then say, look, you know, if you want to do it yourself, you can, because often this is some sort of open source offering or something like that, or they can build a comparable technology. But so if you want to do it yourself, you can. But by the way, I'm the expert. I can do it for you. Here's why you can believe that. Here's where I show you that I know how to do it. And then hopefully by doing that, that message will resonate with some people and the customers will come. Is that kind of a good summary of your kind of tenets or your
That's the developer content mind trick that you're referring to there, where you go super deep on a topic and really point out the edge cases that someone might not have considered, because a developer is likely to want to try to build something. That's almost always where a developer starts from. And I think many times with the build versus buy, which is kind of the classic marketing content piece that you give to a technical person in that scenario, it really pushes that buy and kind of makes it seem like, oh, isn't it silly that you're thinking about building? But that's immediately telling this person who is in this mindset that they're wrong, right? Yeah. And so I think it's much more palatable as a developer to receive that message if you're taken a little further down that path of, here's what it really looks like to build this yourself. And so that is definitely a big piece of the approach. And I think that finding the problems that a developer is experiencing and speaking to those, and you have to make the pivot to your product at some point, typically, but finding a really authentic way to do that and not forcing that is important.
Not forcing it.
Yeah. But that content doesn't all have to be the sort of super deep type of content that you're referring to, which I know you had in an episode here on Bootstrapped also.
Yeah. We talked about it after we launched our reverse geocoding guide that you helped us work on. It's so hard though, because, you know, on the one hand, I totally get what you're saying, that no one, developers hate to be sold to, and no one likes this kind of like, you're an idiot if you do it yourself. Here's 15 reasons why, you know. That just comes off as over the top. On the other hand, you have so little time with your audience, right? People are so busy and they have such a short attention span, and it's very difficult to, you know, the typical advice people always say amongst bootstrappers or amongst SaaS, talk with your customers. No developer wants to talk with me. No one. No, I mean, I think maybe in 5 years, maybe like two people have ever written to me and be like, hey, can we have a call about this? No one wants to do that, right? Developers do not want to talk. They want to just like explore a little bit on their own. And so you don't, you know, you kind of feel like, oh, when I finally get this guy's attention, then I need to sell, sell, sell. I mean, that's just a natural instinct. And it's so hard to hold off from doing that. Let me ask another question. Is a lot of the advice out there for selling to developers or building services for developers, it kind of presumes on the assumption that you're some big business, like with, you know, like a VC funded startup or these big startups, and or I go to conferences, you know, and there'll be companies, you know, not recently, but back when we used to have physical conferences, you know, companies would have multiple DevRel people there talking or whatever. And they have more people in their DevRel team than I have in my company. Right.
Yeah.
So let's maybe focus on some advice. What, you know, where's the leverage that a bootstrapped founder can have? What are the low hanging fruit there? What advice do you have there for people?
Yeah. So it's interesting you mentioned DevRel, because DevRel can sometimes from the outside can seem like a technical person kind of selling, but DevRel done really well is getting feedback from developers and bringing that back to product. And for bootstrapped people, again, that sounds like we're talking about these different departments here, but I think for bootstrappers are in a good spot is that product and DevRel, that's probably the founder.
That's right? One person.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. So when you do get a chance to get out at events, you don't have to have a big booth to talk to people. So you can attend an event that has the right developers and have those, put your DevRel hat on and have those conversations, and then bring those, that feedback back to your product hat self after the event and take actions based on that. But then also, those sorts of conversations are just gold for being able to come up with content ideas, which is a huge part of what the book is about, is how to implement those specific types of content. And so being able to, the same way that you would build a feature because you've heard about that from users, you can write content because you've heard things from people, problems that a developer has, ways that they've attempted to use your service or a competitor's service in the past, and be able to turn that into content. Now, that also takes time, but bootstrappers are used to doing a lot of different things. And so, but
well, I guess just the frustration I have is as I make my way around the internet and I look at other services, not even competitive services to us, but just other services targeting developers, you know, it can often get frustrating because just it feels like the bar of quality keeps rising and rising and rising in terms of, like, now everyone is like, well, if your documentation isn't as good as Stripe's documentation, it's shit. But guess what? Stripe probably, I don't know how many hundred people has Stripe has working on documentation. But I don't have 100 people working on documentation, you know? So it's a struggle now.
Yeah.
It can be demotivating.
Yeah, I can understand that completely. For many companies who are targeting developers, don't need to have Stripe level documentation. If you are truly developer first, you know that what bar is going to, that's setting a bar for sure. But I actually think that there are less truly developer first companies than we think. And even some who consider themselves developer first might not actually be. And whether you are comes from really understanding who is discovering you and how they would. And so if it's true kind of technical infrastructure that's really deeply part of engineering workflow, that's very likely to be developer first. But in many cases, just because you have an API and developers use it to consume your service doesn't necessarily mean that the problem that you solve is a developer problem. So, I mean, even take reverse geocoding, which is definitely a
pretty developer tool. Topic,
yeah. it's pretty technical. But if you go up a level from that, who is asking for reverse geocoding? They likely have a business problem to solve. Now,
yeah, that's certainly true. Yeah.
I think in most cases, what tool is used to solve that business problem is up to developers. But in other cases, especially if there's like a front end SaaS to that product, if that product is not strictly for developers, then someone else in the company might bring that product to a developer to do the actual integration. So, you know, things like content management APIs, of which there are many now, you know, marketing or anyone else who is changing the site and wants to have that sort of access is more likely to be the buyer and the true audience. And so then you have more of a, what I call a developer enabled company versus a developer focused company. And so I think that's one of the first questions for a bootstrap founder to ask, because they'll save themselves a lot of work not having to go for a Stripe-like experience.
Yeah, I mean, the reality is you just don't have the resources to be excellent in every facet of your business, right? So you've got to pick and choose which one you are. I mean, let's talk about another one. Another bit of advice that you always hear people is, you should create a community around your product. And, you know, and some brands do this really well, right? And they're able to use the community kind of as a way to get feedback about the product, but also as a multiplier to get the message out or whatever. But it's, of course, a lot of work. So what would your advice there in the developer realm of building a community? How should someone go about that? Should they go about it? Is it particularly given the limited resources of a bootstrapper? Have you seen people doing this well? Is this a bad idea? Good idea?
You know, I think it's pretty hard to decide that you want it and then go and do it. I think you have to look for those bright spots of it already existing in some way.
I see.
The much shorter version for bootstrappers would be find an existing community and become part of it. So I worked at a database as a service. We chose Node. This would have been 5+ years ago, so sort of still kind of early in Node, but not too early. So there was a Node community, and that was sort of where we went first. And that at least gave us some kind of, we could break away from all potential possibilities, and it gave us some focus. It told us what meetup we could go to.
Right. Focus on these guys. Yeah.
Yeah. And what examples to go a little deeper on. And so I think, and that's a language community, but I think there are definitely framework communities within the language communities.
Yeah.
There are industry communities like you have done with Geo.
Yeah, I mean, we try to piggyback quite a bit on the OpenStreetMap community, which is a very vibrant community. But, you know, it's also a crowded community, and there are other brands there as well. Well, very thought-provoking. I have to say, you know, it's interesting because one of the big challenges I find now as a bootstrap founder whose business, you know, my business, we're no longer worried about the kind of existential issues of like, you know, are we going to have enough money, you know, to pay ourselves next month or whatever. But, of course, we still want to grow and we still have ambition and things. So, but then you do kind of get into the existential question of like, okay, I have the bandwidth, I could work on anything. But I can only work on one or two things. We only have the resource to work on one or two things. So which thing should it be, right? And so I found your book very helpful in terms of kind of forming a framework to try to channel our limited resources and your newsletters over the years. So yeah, very thought-provoking. And I just want to say thanks. It's great. So
yeah, and I think for listeners to the sort of Stripe sets this high bar that you can't reach. The foundational chapter is on developer experience and breaks it down into 13 areas. And I would say if I was a founder, I might look at just one of those for a short while, right? Like you don't have to do the full thing right away. And yeah, and looking sort of at, look at that first, that hello world experience, the getting started experience, for example, and how quickly are you getting someone to actual code on their machine? Like I see many getting started that sort of take you through, let me tell you everything.
High level concepts and everything. Yeah.
Because you have done it for so long. And that sort of content is actually better put into the guide type of topic that like the reverse geocoding guide.
Right.
And getting started should really be all right, what language are you using? Here we go. We have some stuff. Yeah, you're ready to go, right? And then another mistake I see with getting started is that there are multiple getting started guides. And so then someone is like, well, what do I want to get started with? And you might have multiple products or multiple features, definitely multiple use cases, but I think choosing one so that you can really optimize that first experience. And then at the end of that, it's, oh, here is your next steps. And that's when you can say, try this other use case that you know is a super common one, but is maybe a little more involved than a Hello World.
Well, that does get to another question, though, because now, you know, our business, we've been running for, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years now. And so, of course, over time, we have done more and more content kind of piles up, and all of it's well-intended or whatever. But then all of a sudden you realize, like, oh, Christ, I got to maintain all this. And yeah, people are landing on the wrong page, you know, and coming in from the way you didn't anticipate. And it needs to, you know, so maybe you need to, maybe the next book would be about how to prune back your developer marketing. So,
right. Yeah.
Right. First, that's also a good business strategy, right? First, you sell them one book to how to create the content, then the next book to how to reduce
now
it.
Now you've done so much that you need to organize.
You need to focus. All right. Well, Adam, I mean, hard to believe, but half an hour is almost over. So what else? Any closing thoughts or any final messages you have for our listeners out there? Beyond, I don't know if I'm happy to tell them they should definitely buy the book, because I did find it very thought-provoking. Both some tangible actions of like, oh, we should do this, but also more just how to think about, you know, our strategy going forward, and like what things should we work on, what things should we not work on. I found it quite helpful in that regard.
So. Yeah, I think, you know, In closing, bootstrappers should remember that they're actually really set up well for this, because they're closer to their customers than others. They likely, if they're developer focused, have some of that background. And so really it's about remembering the problems that you're helping developers solve, and then making sure that you reach them in a way that sends that message authentically. And then that is kind of that reverse mind trick. The reason that developer marketing doesn't exist is that you're reaching people with something that they actually want to read, and then they're thankful for that, and they can see that you are you have the answer. And
right. So, then the next logical step is they should become a customer and work with
exactly.
You.
So. Yeah.
All right. Well, on that note, good luck with the further promotion of the book and the launch and your bootstrap business in general. And thanks for coming on the show. How can people best get in touch with you?
Everydeveloper.com. It's a good spot to go.
Yeah, and I know they can buy the book there as well. Right? I know you got links to
the
different ones. So yeah, no, thanks for coming on and good luck. And maybe we'll get you back in a year or so. You can tell us how it all went and whether it would be interesting to do an episode just about like, is the strategy of buying a book of writing a book and promoting the book, is that as a marketing strategy? I'd be interested in that, of like how tangible the benefits of that are. So, all right.
Well, cool.
Good talking with you.
We've got it scheduled for a year then.
All right.
I'll see you then.
Bye.
See ya.